So, what a fine assembly we have tonight. A couple questions for you. How many of you have heard of Tassajara? Raise your hand if you have heard of Tassajara. Almost everybody. And how many of you have been there? About half of you. Okay. Well, for the benefit of the couple of people who haven't heard of it, I want to let you know what it is, because I'm going to be talking a bit about Tassajara and practice, and what is Tassajara practice, and how does it connect with Santa Cruz Zen Center Warm Jewel Temple. So Tassajara is a Zen monastery, and it's up in the mountains at the far upper end of Carmel Valley, and it has been in existence for many decades. I don't know the exact year it was founded. Do some of our 71, I was going to say senior members. When were you there, Jeff?
Well, it was 55 or 6. I don't know what founded means.
But you were there then, yes. Back in the day. So it's...
I was
there. Okay. So it was founded back in the mid to late 60s by Suzuki Roshi, who is the founder of our stream here in America of the kind of Soto Zen that we practice. His photograph is in the back of the altar. And, hi. It was the first Zen monastery that was established in America. And so it was a very important contribution to Zen practice in America that this place was established, where we could go and do monastic practice in the style of the ancestors. And in 39, oh, one more thing to say. In the fall and in the winter at Tassajara, they have what's called a practice period. And that's a 3-month time when people go and practice very intensely, kind of a traditional schedule with a lot of zazen and study and work and some bits and pieces of time off. And then, of course, in the summer, many people know that they open their doors to the general public and it becomes a resort and a workshop facility. And all the monks who've been studying Zen and working hard at their practice, they basically run a hotel. And it's a place where people can go and can get refuge from the busy world, can take workshops, can go and soak in the hot springs. So it's a kind of an interesting blend of a place that, you know, opens to the general world for part of the year, and then the gate closes formally, and it becomes a monastery. Though it always is a monastery, really. It just that its function kind of shifts a little bit. So with that preface, some of you know and some of you don't, but in 39 days, I'm going there. And I'm going to go and I'm going to do a 3-month monastic practice period at Tassajara. It will be the third time that I've done this. I did one in 2001 and I did one in 2006. And when I completed my practice period in 2006, I swore to myself I would never do it again. I made myself promise that I would never do it again. I was so tired. It's so hard to get up early in the morning for me. I really like 8 hours of sleep. No, I need 8 hours of sleep to be psychologically healthy, I tell myself. And the schedule is pretty relentless. I mean, every day, you know, you're run by the bells. The bells tell you what to do, and you do it. And you do the same thing every day over and over. And it's a very focused kind of activity. And those of you who know me might know that I enjoy, you know, being a woman of the world. I like my freedom. I like being out and about. I like comfort. I like pleasure. This has always been one of my big dilemmas in terms of being a practitioner is how to have my different tendencies meet and not feel separate and dualistic. So, you know, I did it in 2006, and I just said, this is it for me. I'm getting older, and I'm not going to do this again. So why am I going back? That's the theme of this talk. It's an inquiry. It's not something that I have figured out, but I wanted to explore a little bit with you this question of why would I go back? Not so, well, you might have some interest in my little personal story, but more so, I think, it's because I want to kind of dig in with you to this question of this kind of circumstance we can get in where we think we know what we want in our life. We think we kind of have this idea about who we are and the kind of person we are and how to set things up to be the kind of person that we think we are. And then something happens, whether it's something that we don't choose that just happens that changes our life, or whether we decide to do something that we can't understand quite why we're doing it. I think that that's an interesting place to inquire. Who is the one who said yes? Who is the one who said, I'm going to do this, even though, you know, I had said no. It's kind of the voice beyond the rational mind that sometimes calls to us and invites us to do things that we don't understand, but we do them anyhow. Or if it's something that's happened in our life that's difficult and that we're struggling with and that we wish we could turn away from, this call can also be something then that we just say, I know this is really hard, but I'm going to turn towards this call and I'm going to see what happens. So, I'm just curious, have any of you ever just not, I don't want to get into discussion yet, though I do want to have some discussion and answer any questions that you might have. How many of you have ever felt at some point in your life that you had a kind of a call? It was something that you didn't understand why, and it seemed maybe even different from who you think you are, but you heard it and you responded. I'm just curious if others of you have had that experience. And how many of you have had a situation where something happened and even though you really didn't want it to happen and you don't like it, you nonetheless came to see it as some kind of a call to turn towards something different? Okay. So maybe that would be something at some point in the talk here I'd love to hear what your experiences have been. I also realize, once again, I didn't bring up a clock, so could you let me know when it's about quarter after? Thank you, yeah. So one story that I've been telling myself in terms of why did I say yes to this thing that I had said no to is I've been telling it as the story of the third mountain. So, you know that Zen story when I first started, maybe you do, maybe you don't. When I first started practice, there was a mountain, and then I continued to practice and I realized that there wasn't a mountain. But now that I have practiced a while longer, I realize there is a mountain. And those of you of a certain age might remember the song by good old Donovan. There is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is, right? So, so one little story I can tell is that the first time that I went to Tassajara in 2001 was the first mountain. And that would be the mountain of yes, the mountain of being very enamored with Zen practice and quite starry-eyed about it. And quite in love with everything, And oh, the wonderful bells and the wonderful forms and the wonderful teachings. And this is so great that I can just turn my life over to this fantastic practice and be in this beautiful place where everybody's practicing together. It was so beautiful and so wonderful in 2001. Yes, yes, yes. So then in 2006, I could say it was the second mountain, which is the mountain of, oh, I'm not so sure anymore. This is really harder than I thought. I don't know if this works for me. Why am I doing this? What is this robe? Why do I have a black robe on now? What does it mean? I could call this the mountain of no. The mountain of no. Doubt, great doubt, right? And we say this in Zen, that we have great faith and we have great doubt, and both are very, very important parts of practice. Because great doubt is when we question the teaching, and we question ourselves in the teaching. You know, Buddha said, don't take my word for it. Find out for yourself. Check it out for yourself. Don't take my word for it. So for some of us, sometimes we have to say no. We have to say, I'm not sure. We have to say, let me check it out for myself. So there were also a bunch of things going on in my life. I don't have to get into the stories. You know, we all have these different seasons in our life. But it became important for me to say no and to find my no in Zen. And I would say that I'm just now starting to be ready to leave the era of no. because I think I have fully explored the no. I think I've gone as far into the no as I want, because the truth is I do love this practice. And I do even love morning zazen. Even though you haven't seen me here for a while in the mornings. So this voice beyond the rational mind of mine that said about a year ago, you know, I think I really do want to do practice period next fall, and started setting up my life to do that, because it takes a long time for me to undo and prepare and go, save money and all that. And it was kind of like, okay, if I've explored the yes and I've explored the no, what is it that is beyond yes and no? What is this third mountain that they talk about? First there is, and then there isn't. And then having been fully in the yes and fully in the no, then what? So that's one reason why I think I'm going, because I'm curious about it. What is this third mountain? What is this place that's beyond yes and no? What is this place that's beyond my identity, either as an enthusiastic, gung-ho, good girl, Zen girl, or a cranky, I don't want a bad Zen girl, you know? Who is it that's neither or both? I'm not sure, but that's part of what it is. And I was sharing this three mountains logic model with a Dharma sister, and because she asked me what I was going to talk about tonight, she couldn't be here. And I told her, well, about my three mountain theory. And she says, well, that's fine, but please don't present it as a linear thing, because it's not linear. So I must do due diligence tonight and tell you that it's not linear. It's something that we circle through our whole life. Our faith and our doubt, and then this third place. Gene and I were talking a few weeks ago, and I said to him, what do you think the third place is, if the first place is faith and the second place is doubt? And first he said he had heard that the three pillars of Zen, that the third is determination. And I said, nah, it doesn't work for me. What else you got? And then he thought about it a little bit more, and he said, well, I think there's another translation where it's like settling. You said that, right? Settling. And I thought, okay, that, I resonate with that, settling. I want to settle in being this one who's gone, who's climbed the first mountain and the second mountain and is now kind of settling into, well, what is this? But it's not linear, mind you. I was thinking about, you know, those of you who took, how many took the five ranks class? Not too many, just a few. But I was thinking it's kind of like the fourth rank, the integration of yes and no, you know. So that was one idea that I had. But I also wanted to say a little bit about the little glimmers that I've had about this one who is somehow neither yes nor no. The first time I did it in 2001, you know, the hardest thing for me, I confess, it's waking up at, you know, 3:15 in the morning. That's the thing that gets me. You know, it's almost like if I could just get up at 7, I would have no problem doing the rest of the stuff there. Because I enjoy the Zazen, I enjoy the study, I enjoy the work, I enjoy the community. You know, I don't mind, I like the rigor. That's my difficulty, is that getting up in the morning and being so tired. But I did have a little clue in 2001, kind of about halfway through. You know, first I resisted it and I resisted it, and then I realized I'm going to be miserable if I continue to resist this wake up. And so I just really tried practicing, you know, the alarm would go off, and rather than having my mind go, you know, say some expletive, and, you know, I started considering that there might be another mind. There might actually be another mind. And, you know, who would I be without the thought of, darn, that alarm is so, going off so early. What if I didn't think that thought? What's that mind? And I also remember feeling that sometimes really good things happen when the ego gets really exhausted. It's just so, it's too tired to think those thoughts. Those self-critical thoughts, those judgmental thoughts, those, it's just tired. And so then there's this kind of beauty, this kind of ragged beauty that unfolds in this place, in this narrow little canyon where all these people are making this same effort. And you see everybody's fatigue, and everybody's kind of raggy looking and sore and, you know, shuffling around in their black robes in the dark. And then there's just this incredible beauty, you know, that is there and that's available to us, that you can also taste here. You know, if you come here and you sit sesshin, which one's coming up, a three-day sesshin is coming up, I think, can people still sign up? Yeah. Sesshin gives you a little taste of that, you know? A little bit of that, oh, I'm so tired, but, oh, isn't this beautiful? How we're all just doing this thing together, and how open our hearts are, and how vulnerable we can be together, just doing this ancient practice that we don't quite understand, that it, and that even seems kind of crazy. But isn't it beautiful? So another thing that I know that I'm saying yes to is the opportunity to practice with the mountains and the rivers. And this is a time-honored Zen tradition. If you read the stories of the ancestors, especially, you know, the Chinese ancestors, but I think the Japanese ancestors too, a lot of their practice was in the mountains and with the rivers. the mountains and rivers run through all the teachings, that the ancient teachings that we have. So there's a feeling too of doing the rituals and sitting zazen, you know, being up in the mountains when the day breaks and hearing the birds and hearing the river and hearing the river grow louder when the rains start and seeing the stars so clear at night when you leave the zendo and it's mostly dark and then there's just stars and all these people single file quietly just walking down the path to their little huts and there's the densho bell ringing. It's very visceral, very emotional, not cerebral at all. And I think this is a big part of Zen. You know, we come here and we talk and we have these words and we have classes and lectures and everybody tries to talk about it. But I think that, you know, this experience that we have of sitting together, which we all just did, is just, well, just as important. It's all important, but it's a huge part of this particular practice. Is this nonverbal body emotion world that we inhabit together, and that has sound, that has bells, you know, the small bell, the big bell, the chanting that we do during service. And another, so there's that part. And another aspect of going there is I really feel like, and this is why I wanted to talk about it with you, I really want to offer it to you as if there's any way that my practice and my practice of going there is something that could support you here in town, in the town life and the town practice. I would like to offer that, whether it's just as simple as the fact that you know that I'm there and we think about each other, and to make kind of a link between the monastery and the town temple, to know that there's a little bit of Santa Cruz up there. You know, if you go down to the Pleasure Point and you look at the Monterey Bay and you look at those mountains that are right on the other side of the Monterey Bay, that's the Ventana. And so if you just kind of go a little bit deeper into those mountains, that's where Tassajara is. And I know that when I long for Tassajara, I go down to the bay and I look at those mountains and I know it's there and I know that there's monks there and they're practicing every, you know, 24/7. There's this practice that's going on up there. And if you want to write to me, I will answer all letters. If you haven't done snail mail for a while and you'd like to get a letter from Tassajara, I'll post the address and I mean it, swear to God, I will swear to Buddha. It's really exciting getting mail there. There's, you know, Gene and I will talk once a week for 10 minutes on the one phone that's there. But basically, you know, there's no email, there's no talking on the phone, there's no cell phone reception, there's no texting. So other than very minimal, you know, just staying in touch with the home base, it's snail mail. So I offer that if anybody would like to have any kind of correspondence, or if you just want the thrill of a real live postcard from Tassajara. I'll probably paint the postcard since they don't have postcards. Or the other thing I was thinking is that if anybody has some intention or aspiration or wish and something that you'd like to sort of just give me some kind of object that represents your aspiration or your intention, I'd be happy to put it on my altar in my room. I'll have a little altar that I'll set up, and if you want to have a little something of you up there, that's another thing that I was thinking I'd be happy to do. So I wanted to tell you about this. It's been a while since one of us has gone up there. And so I'd love to make it an offering for y'all, too, not just this personal thing. And interestingly enough, the theme of this practice period is about Sangha and cultivating Sangha, which is, I think, the first time. It's usually some kind of, you know, sutra or something, you know, that is being studied up there. But this, the abbess exiting abbess, I think she's exiting due to health care issues, but she is really into the community, cultivation of community. So that's going to be the theme of the practice period. So all the better to be connected with this beloved Sangha. And, you know, you can do a practice period here, too. That's the other thing that's really cool to know, is that you don't have to go to Tassajara. It's hard to go to Tassajara. Not everybody can go. Most of us can't take 3 months out of our life and just drop off the face of the earth and go practice in the mountains. But in the fall and in the winter, there's a little practice period right here in Santa Cruz at this very Zendo. And the way we do it here is that you get to design your own schedule. So you don't even have to follow somebody else's schedule. You can follow your own schedule. And if you want to, you know, push your edge a little bit and commit yourself to maybe doing a little bit more Zazen than you usually do, or coming in early if you usually come in the evening, or committing to coming every Wednesday night, or, you know, something like that, you can make your very own custom-designed intensified practice period. And so you could do that. I think it starts in October, November, and then usually ends at the beginning of December with the Rahatsu. So that's another thing. If there's anything in what I'm saying that you're thinking, you might be thinking, oh, my God, I would never want to do that. But you may be thinking, ooh, that sounds kind of interesting. So if you think it sounds kind of interesting, or if you just want to listen to that voice outside that and do something really different from who you think you are and what you usually do, I recommend the practice of practice period as a practice. So I think at this point, what is the time, Richard?
7:07.
7 after. Okay. I think it would be really great for me at this point to hear if you have any questions that you would like to ask. I'd love to engage with you. And also, if you would like to share and talk about any of the things that you were thinking when you raised your hand about a time when you responded to a call from outside of your sort of normal rational structure of who you think you are, what was that, and what happened? Yes.
Mm-hmm. In that conversation, I may not have made it very clear, but it is settled in I don't know.
Oh.
So there's a kind of unsettledness about I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's settling in I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes for me and others, I don't know, and bringing that into one's life is frightening. How do you do life with a question?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, for you, how do you work with the fear that might come up of the third mountain settled in I don't know?
Well, of course, when you bring up I don't know, what that makes me immediately think about is not knowing is most intimate, which is one of our teachings and one of my favorite lines in Zen. And so being intimate with not knowing is, at this moment, I actually don't feel afraid of it. I actually feel rather looking forward to it. Um, I feel very open to learning and seeing and feeling what I don't know. And I trust my internal resources to get myself through the loneliness and the crankiness and the kind of things that happen when you do something like that. Yeah.
Ask who I am. I tell them it's about religion. Asking who I am, I say that I'm a practicing Catholic and a practicing Buddhist. I always carry this Christian side with me through all of everything that I do. That's also the Buddhist side of me. I was recently reading a book that is called The Trinity and the Law of Three. The Trinity is a Christian conception of God. Okay. The law of three, it's a triad. So you can think of it, it's not linear, it's a triad. And the first one, you maybe think about when you're talking about the three mountains, because the first one is the holy affirming, yes.
Mm-hmm.
A second point is the holy denying, no. And the third one is the holy reconciling between the first and the second. It is that energy that into that triad that they do, that it does not work without that energy of the third piece, the holy reconciling into that. And what it creates is a fourth understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, if it's a law, and then it is way bigger than religion. And this theologian, a bunch of great pains, Kokyo has the book right now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because he was interested in what I had to say about it. But that's what made me think.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it is the three mountains, this triad, and I spend these days a lot of time and off. Reconciling portion for me.
Yeah.
Holy affirming Catholicism, the holy denying Buddhism, both equally important. Not one better than the other, both equally important. And the holy reconciling, which is who knows what that emerges from me. I mean, that's where I spend my life is wondering what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for this.
Yeah. And, I think what you're bringing up, I mean, it's so present in all of our Zen is, this idea of reconciling, integrating the apparent duality, the seeming opposites, and how we do that, I think, is a huge part of each of our practices. Maybe not everybody, but I think a lot of people are working with some kind of sense of duality. The thing that I think I can do, the thing I think I can't do, the person I wish I was, the person I am, or points in our religious teaching of, form and emptiness or the absolute and the relative. So yeah, I think we are really most often working in that integrative, reconciling place. Yeah, Jeff.
Going somewhere, you have that impression, and then the second time, maybe it's not what you thought it was the first time, and then the third time seems to be more what it is. And then the other thing, I don't know if people have put up teepees, but three is the first number that you can that stands alone.
That's true.
One can't do it, two can't do it.
The tripod. Yeah, right.
Kathy, when you described settling, I've been going through what I feel is a similar phenomena in kind of a feeling tone in the mood that you put.
Mm-hmm.
And come for me. And when you said settling, it just resonated so well. But my description became acceptance. And the acceptance was not just giving up.
Mm-hmm.
It was finding this peaceful place of not striving and not judging, but just doing.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't help but, when you said settle, it just resonated with that same feeling that I had, this kind of peaceful acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it extremely difficult to drop judgment. However, I think that's the key.
Thank you. Yes, Val.
Can you talk a little bit about this practicing with the mountain and the rivers? Either one example or a general.
Sure. Well, just the feeling of being surrounded by mountains is really a beautiful feeling for me, to feel their bones, to try to see their bones, to go up on ridges and see the ways that they're interconnected. Mountains they're really alive for me. And there's both this, like, the particularity of the details that make up the mountain, like the rocks and the bugs and the plants and the flowers and the dirt. And then there's also just this big sort of scale view of mountain, which is ridge and line. And so it's kind of a depiction for me in the world of some of the things I try to reconcile in my mind and in the teachings, you know, like form and emptiness or something like that, you know, where there it is, where there is this form, you know, these individual forms of the different particular things that make up the mountain. But the mountain itself is almost like the emptiness, because it isn't any one of those things. It's all of those things. It's, you know, so just that kind of seeing the teaching and feeling the teaching of the natural world. And of course, river for me is really helpful, because the river is also, you know, it's form and emptiness, because it's always changing every second. You know, if you watch a river, you just, there's no little water drop that stays solid. And yet, if you step back and you look, it's the river, right? So there's that level, and then there's also the auditory for me, of just being exposed to those sounds that are like sounds of awakening for me. Making a distinction where, you know, the town sounds, there's nothing wrong with the town sounds. And in fact, there's delightful human sounds there that I feel very tender towards. And for me, it's just this real feeling of relief and refuge to be able to spend so much time in the natural world with, you know, with elements like wind and water and mountain, that here tend to be elements like road and car and store and task and calendar. So it's like different objects in my field that I'm interacting with, and that are kind of the things that are making up my experience and my reality. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could think of us on Monday evening.
Sure.
Because the Doshi won't be here in form.
Yes, Monday evenings. I will. At 5:45 is actually service time in Tassajara.
Oh, thank you.
Dahishan Dharani, in fact. Speak of the devil. Yeah, exactly. Well, and this is another thing, too, that you bring up. And, you know, I feel kind of embarrassed to say this, but I'm going to say it, because I do believe in the power of making declarations to groups of people. When I've only in my life ran one marathon, it was a huge deal for me. And the what helped me do it was I was a school teacher at the time, and I used it as a motivational strategy for my students, for them to have goals about things that they wanted to accomplish. I said I had this goal that I wanted to accomplish, and I would wanted them to hold me accountable to doing it. And so I had them ask them to check in with me about how it was going and how my training was going. And then I knew that I had to do it because my little beady eyes were, you know, well, Ms. Coldy, how's it going? You know, and they knew the date and they, you know, they knew I'd paid my money and everything. So I, you know, that I ran the marathon and I never did it again. So anyhow, I want to say that, you know, there is an aspect for me of going there where I'm, this may sound crude, but I feel like I'm wanting to push my reset button in terms of my way that I structure my time. And I have not been here very much for the last 5 months. I just, other things got onto my calendar and pushed my commitments here aside. And I don't want to live that way. So there's a way, kind of selfishly, that going away for 3 months really clears the calendar. It clears the deck. It's a really, really good method. If you ever feel like you're getting really crazed with commitments, you just, you know, I call it the stone in the river. This is, you know, in my own little psychology world. You know, the stone in the river, it's like I go, okay, I'm putting this big rock down there, and I know that it's going to totally alter the way that the water flows. So this is a stone in the river, you know, which is clearing my calendar, and I really am really wanting to be able to be more committed to fulfilling, to setting and fulfilling a lot more presence here and responsibility than I've been allowing or been able to do in the last while. So I'm saying that to all of you so that you can ask me about it. Yeah, so that you can ask me about it when I come back. Yes? Well, and I think that is one of the special things about this particular kind of practice that we do here is that, you know, we do have these rituals and there are these sort of familiar things that we do over and over. And, you know, for some people, they see that as it's too much for them and they don't want to do it. But for those of us that like it, I think that's part of what we like is we like some sense of familiarity and repetition and falling into this thing that is, you're intimate with it. You're intimate with it. It's like Monday night, you know, we know what we're going to chant, and we learn the forms. I remember you, when you first started, it was, you know, a little awkward and everything, but then you found your voice, and you found your way in, and now it's like you know how to do that service, and, you know, and Jeff does the Makugyo, and I'm the Doshi, and then the people come and they chant, and, you know, different nights, there's different chants, and I see that many of you, you know, who come in the evenings, of course in the morning as well, but it's been really sweet seeing the evening groups come forth, and, you know, the people that do that Thursday night chant. How many of you come Thursday night? I'm just curious. Are any of the Thursday night people? Richard, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a really exotic chant, you know, but there's this set of people that come, and they can do it now, and they do it really well, and they know how to do this Japanese, you know, it's kind of one of the most esoteric things we do, but they do it, they know how to do it, and they probably come Thursday because they like it. So I think that this is one of the opportunities that we can take refuge, you know, in this ever-changing world where things are unpredictable and sometimes there's sadness about that. There's a real intimacy to come and know that, you know, the familiarity of the body, you know, bowing. I mean, the teaching, you know, that many of us had in the early days with Catherine where, you know, there weren't very many people here when she first came, and sometimes it would just be Catherine and one other person. Or two other people, you know, but she'd come every day and she would do those bows in the same kind of slow way. And she would, you know, do the approaching the altar the same slow way. And you just, your body just learns so much. And there's so much intimacy with just that. The different ways that different people move, you know, and you get to know, oh, I know so-and-so just came in the Zendo, even though you're not looking. You know who it is, right? Because you go, you know their footstep or you know their breath. And that's intimacy. That's intimacy. Yeah.
We moved to Santa Cruz about a month ago, but we've been in process of doing that for almost a year now. And I'm a long-term student, but in Modesto of Norman Fisher's. We moved here essentially for the air for my lungs, because after 40 years in Modesto, it's the air is so much better here.
Yeah.
And when we were getting ready to do that, bought our condo down at the bottom of the hill, that was last summer, found out that the Zen Center was right here, and I'd been to it, you know, 20 years ago when our daughter was going to UCSC, but not really since. And that was such a blessing, and continues to be. And we spent the last 10 months downsizing, selling the house, getting everything ready, and moved and in. And now we're sort of coming up. It's a beautiful place. And it's a sunset. It's a 7-minute walk, 72 steps.
Wow.
62, it's 72. So, kind of a thing. It's good exercise, but above all, a really supportive, loving community. And I really appreciate that, and my wife Joyce comes when she came too, and she's not a regular citizen. We hosted a group in Modesto for a number of years, and yeah, but yeah, so it's just wonderful to be here.
I wanted to say one more thing that I thought about with this intimacy thing is, I don't know how many of you know Greg Fain, but he's the Tanto, the head of practice now at Tassajara. And when I first went in 2001, he had not even yet been ordained as a priest. He was studying to be a priest, but he wasn't even yet ordained as a priest. But he was my the leader of my little cohort. When you're a first time, when you do the practice period for the first time, you're called a Tongario student. And what that means is, first of all, one of the things it means is that there's a Zen initiation ritual. For the first time you enter the monastery, which is that you sit for 5 days, like all day, with hardly any breaks. I know, it's like an initiation ritual, you know, like how they used to throw you out into the wilds with no clothes kind of thing. Well, it's sort of like that. You know, anyhow, so you go through this really, 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 really hard experience, and then you're in, you know, you're in. But anyhow, you're called a Tongario student. And the Tongariro students, one of the things that you do is that you do a lot of the basic, certain basic jobs. Like one of the jobs you do is you go around and light the lanterns before everybody gets up in the morning. And you blow them out at night after everybody goes to bed. And you also do the serving. So you're in a cohort with a serving crew, and then you have a leader. So you really bond with your fellow Tongariro students and your serving crew. And it's really nice to have a little group of people that you belong to. So Greg was my small group leader, so I really connected with him. Anyhow, he was training me to do one of the other jobs, which is the fire watch. And the fire watch in Tassajara is these sticks like claves, you know, the instrument that people play. And you walk, and it's like, I forget, like every sixth step or something like that, you hit the stick. So you start up at the top of the path, and you walk like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, click, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, click. And then this is a signal to people basically who are supposed to be getting ready to go to bed in their huts, that it's kind of like a lights out sort of a thing. And then after they do that, if your light is still on, they'll come and they'll like knock on your door and make sure you know that it's supposed to be lights out. Anyhow, kerosene lanterns. And they don't want you and burn the place down, right? So it has a function. Oh, it's about, save all bees. Thank you, Reverend Tiberbaugh, for pointing out my confusion. Appreciate that. But all of this is just a way to tell you this line, which is, so part of the experience of, you walk to your hut at night, and you're hearing the densho bell, and you get into your little hut, and you're like, it's all dark and you're getting ready to go to bed. And then you hear outside, you hear this click, 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 click. And that's one of those sounds, you know, it's one of those kind of feelings of this intimacy, you know, every night, click, click, click. And dear Greg, when he was teaching me how to do that role, the way he expressed doing that, he says, this is the romance of the monastery. And I've always remembered that as a way to talk about this kind of this intimacy, you know. And you know, the fact that we think that's wonderful is really insane. But, you know, once you get bitten by the Zen bug, watch out, because you'll find all sorts of things to be wonderful that are like, really? But that's one of them. Well, what time is it?
7:34.
Oh, well, it's time to stop. It's time for tea. So let's stop. I apologize, I went a little over. So everybody, may your practice this fall, may we all practice together in one big circle of enjoyment. Beings are numberless. I bow to save.